Tonight on Arena, director Alex Garland tells us about his new movie, Civil War, and Andrew O'Hagan talks about his new novel, Caledonian Road. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch proceedings live if you are so inclined on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. We start tonight with theatre, in fact, celebrating Rough Magic's 40th anniversary. Hilary Fannin's adaptation of Maxim Gorky's classic 1905 dark comedy Children of the Sun reworks the original text, draws it into the here and now, travels across space and time. We're in the early 20th century. We come right up to the present day, and we go to places like New York, California, the north of England, London and beyond. Children of the Sun tells the story of how a small family and their odd bunch of friends and one stranger distract, entertain and enrage each other, while beyond their fragile walls, their world is being reshaped by inexorable forces. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by director Lynn Parker and cast member Stuart Graham. Maybe for those who aren't familiar with the original Gorky text, you'd give us a little bit of that background, because it seems to be a play, Lynn, that is done at times when people are in dread fear that something awful is going to happen in the world, which might explain why you're doing it right now.
Well, Gorky wrote it before the whole seismic revolution in Russia, but he said it back in the 19th century during a cholera epidemic. So, you know, pandemics, what have you. And, of course, we are doing it now in the face of seismic changes all around the world. But actually, when the play was first performed, there were riots in the wake of one of the productions. And then, you know, at the same time, the Abbey was setting up and there were riots around its plays. And so that what we're really looking at is the fact that, plus ça change, you know, we keep looking at these shifts in the human experience, in political life and personal life, and we don't seem to be able to escape certain cycles of it. So when we started to look at this play, it was some years ago, and well before Ukraine and well before Gaza and all of that. And really, the play is not about any of these things. It's about our inability to escape conflict, partly by being able apparently to avoid looking at it.
Yeah, so if you bury the elephant underneath the mat or the carpet in the room, the elephant will still be there, but you don't have to. You can pretend it doesn't exist.
Absolutely.
It really is a play of two halves, to use that football analogy. This particular piece, and certainly in the adaptation that Hilary Fannin has given us, I felt when I was reading the opening section, the opening act in particular. Oh, this is straight out of Anton Chekhov. Mm. We're in a big house in the country. Mm-hmm. There's a vet. There's a there's an artist visiting. There's a kind of scientist stroke, slightly insane man at the head of the house who knows nothing about money and leaves it to somebody else to sort all of those things out. It very much is a familiar world in the first half, in the first act.
Yes, and I mean, there are many Chekhovian references, and Gorky and Chekhov knew each other well. But what Hilary has done is explode it in the second half, because she really wanted to find ways in which these characters could almost lead parallel lives, which is one of the themes that Protasov is investigating intellectually in the first. And the notion of us, you know, being able to sort of surface into other lives seemed very interesting. But actually, it all comes full circle, and I don't want to give away any more than that.
Yeah, no, there is. We go explode into all sorts of times in time frames and situations in the second act of the play. But thank you for saying Protasov, because I meant to check that with you before we came to air how we said the title of your character.
That's how you say it.
Well, of course, you probably don't have to say it, Stuart, you're playing him.
Thankfully.
You never have to call him across the stage. Although, in a play like this in the second half, anything could happen. Explain who he is, or what the character said to you, or says to you, particularly in that, I suppose, that first section where we get this man who's full of ideas.
He's full of ideas. He's a scientist. He firmly believes he is on the cusp of a discovery. involving time and or ability to use time to our own advantage. He firmly believes that there are parallel universes out there, and that through the evolution of us as a species, we will at some point,
yeah,
be able to transverse those different
parallel
universes.
Yeah, that we'd be able to be the three of us sitting in this studio now, but we could equally be three similar people in a totally different situation in 100 years' time.
Correct. And he believes
ideally
through
our perfect selves.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, and we can go back, therefore, and undo all of the mistakes. Yeah. Undo, you know, and fix everything that we got wrong. Because again, you know, like Lynn was saying, the play deals with, you know, not just our inability to see conflict when it's right in front of us, but also our propensity to redo the mistakes of the past, to let history repeat itself, both, you know, in society's terms, but also in an individual's terms. We seem to.
Because really the group, I suppose, in some ways, Lynn, in this big house, you know, on the edge of town, in some ways it's a kind of a microcosm of society. That's
exactly
what Gorky was at.
Exactly. And the people in the play are very eccentric, eclectic, but very human and very lovable and very amusing as well. So although the play deals with the kind of advance of catastrophe, it's actually a very human story as well. And it's Hillary's great gift is character and dialogue.
And again, that struck me, Stuart, in that opening section, the kind of in classic Chekhovian stroke, that kind of period in time. Somebody's in love with one person who's in love with somebody else who's in love with somebody else.
Well, totally, yeah. I mean, such is Protasov's obsession with time and with the science that he therefore neglects everything else in his life, his family, his wife, his sister, the income into the family home, and therefore is kind of undoing in the current time frame everything that he's trying to fix in other time frames.
Yeah, well, he's married to Yelena. The character of Melania, as played by Fiona Bell, how would you describe the dynamic between the two of them?
I think, well, no, Lynn?
Mismatched. they exist almost in the same life, but in parallel experiences, you know, and it's very funny watching them try to understand each other and really failing. But that's part of the entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'm going to play a scene that you recorded earlier for us with Fiona Bell, who plays the character of Melania. We'll come back to that name now in a minute. But here's the Protasov character. He's caught up in his mind. He's been sharing books with her. I think she may have other things on her mind, as we will get a sense in this clip, featuring Stuart Graham as Protasov and Melania, played by Fiona Bell.
The only velocity which exists, Yelena, is the velocity of an object in relation to another object. Come back, Yelena. Come back. Time. We need time. Everything progresses. From a single cell to an entire planet, everything progresses. Oh, please, 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 please.
Anyone home?
Melania.
Your door was left open.
And so I see.
Whew, this heat.
Indeed.
Deadening.
You may as well come in.
Bit of a commotion at your gate.
Oh, yes?
Machines panting in the heat like big rusty dogs.
Yelena is dealing with it.
I'm not disturbing you, am I?
Actually.
Yes?
Actually, I'm not entirely displeased to see you, Melania.
Aren't you? That's a good start.
I'd offer you tea, but I've been deserted. My wife. I asked if she might bring boiling water before she left me, outside of her remit, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
So, Melania, you read the book?
Did I?
The one I lent you.
Of course, yes. All the symbols.
Formulas.
Formulas, yes. Compelling. It's a little cooler over there. Do you mind if I...
It's not a work of fiction.
It certainly is not.
I thought you might enjoy the author's disregard for a universal and absolute parameter.
Did you?
Daring.
Daring. You took the word right out of my mouth. Aren't you hot, Pavel? This heat...
Deadening, you've said. Melania, may I ask you a personal question?
I wish you would.
Do you have chickens?
Chickens.
Poultry. Roosters. Hens.
Yes, I have poultry. I have roosters. I have hens.
Wonderful. I want your eggs, Melania.
Do you? Might I trouble you for a glass of water?
So much is expected of me, Melania. I have work to do. Essential, scientific work. And still I am dragged down, denied, freighted by this...
This...
life.
I see it.
Fiona Graham, Fiona Bell, beg your pardon, as Melania not there, yet. And Stuart Graham as Protasov in a scene from Children of the Sun. Not quite at that part of
it. We're not there yet.
Getting on well as colleagues, leaving it at that for sure. And we'll stop that before we get ourselves into all kinds of trouble. You get a sense in that, or certainly I got a sense in that, Lynn, of that there's a kind of an underlying, I think Hilary Fanon's having a lot of fun with the comic potential within all of this. And of course, Chekhov considered himself to be one of the great comedic writers.
Well, you know, it's funny because it's human. And as Alan Bennett says, it's funny because it's accurate. You know, and that's really how we would approach the characterization. You don't want to set up gags. I mean, you don't have to, because human nature is intrinsically ridiculous, and we've had a lot of fun excavating it.
When I said to you, we'll come back to the name of Melania, is it pure coincidence, you know, because obviously when we hear the name Melania today, we think of a certain former US president.
That's really
purely coincidental.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that is the name that Gorky uses in his original. So.
It struck me because, you know, the thing that one of the things that the play has is it's not, you can't pin it down. It's not about Ukraine, or it's not about Gaza, or it's not about any particular situation. But as a play, it has been, I think, the history of the production has been at these times of great worry and fear in the world.
I can't really... Well, kind of that's the point, isn't it? When has there not been?
Being a period of that.
And so the play keeps being relevant. And really, you're quite right. It isn't about those things. And it is more about people like ourselves who are sitting looking at the chaos outside. And, you know, not to get too sort of serious about it, but you know, if you chose any point in history, really, over the last 100 years, you would see all of these undercurrents arising. And Gorky was prescient as well as writing about his own time. Hilary thought she would too.
Yeah, as I say, when it goes into the second half, it's almost impossible to explain what's going on, other than to say, if I say, you know, there's a section of it that's in Italy in 1922, there's a disco section from 1977, we're in a workman's pub in a club in England at some point, we're in California in 1968, and the periods and the locations keep shifting in a way that you could only do in theatre, obviously, you know, because we can imagine ourselves as, or what is going on there.
It's funny, we talked to Professor Iggy McGovern as part of the research for the show, and he said that the big exploration now, the big frontier, was time. And I remember thinking, well, we do that in theatre all the time. We experiment with time. It's just normal for us. Mm. And he was very taken by that. Actually, all of those references are quite nebulous. So it's not really particular to any particular location, although we've kind of signalled some of them.
Yeah.
But in many ways, it could be anywhere.
And I guess I'm wondering, when you're playing a character who, not all of the characters are in all the different time frames and in all the different points in time and locations in time. But as when you're playing a character like that, Stuart, what's that process? Do you think of him as being just the same person in different time frames?
Yes, totally. That's exactly what you do. I mean, you could start bringing in lots of tricks and things and, you know, making things slightly different and altering this, the whole nature-nurture argument. You know, we get into all of that. You can go down all of those roads. But ultimately, the most truthful way, I think, is to do exactly that, is to hold on to the truth of the one character just through different experiences.
Let's have a little listen to some of Mel Mercier's music, which I think gives us a sense of the frantic energy in particular of the second act, I'm calling it, of the play. We'll be right back. just a flavour of some of Mel Mercier's music from the production of Children of the Sun that Lynn Parker and Stuart Graham are speaking with me about this evening. Cardboard City, you were saying, that's what you guys call that piece for some reason.
It's a sort of code that we have to... That one of the scenes was called that. We just use these references to know where we are in the production, but it's not necessary that the
reference anything in that particular regard. Finally, this is a co-production between Rough Magic and the Abbey Theatre. And I suppose there are two things at play there. First of all, as we did a couple of months back, celebrated the 40th anniversary of Rough Magic Theatre Company. But also this is part of the Gregory Project, reference to Lady Gregory within the Abbey itself. Just tell us, how do you see those two particular aspects sitting together?
Well, it's very interesting that, you know, Gorky was writing around the same time as the Abbey was being set up. And it is wonderful for us to be part of this celebration of women and their writing and honouring Lady Gregory, who is quite often overlooked in favour of Yeats. So, it's a wonderful... And it's terrific for us to be working in the Abbey on this particular year. And we're having great fun, I must say.
Right. And finally to you, Stuart, I know obviously television and film has been a big part of your career as well. I'm thinking of Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, I'm thinking of Hunger. But in more recent times, I'm thinking of North Sea Connection and Smother, a bit closer to home. There seems to me to be some kind of renaissance or something happening in terms of Irish television and Irish television productions and film productions at the moment. Do you have a sense of that as an actor?
Yeah, I do. Absolutely. I think that the whole landscape of TV and film in Ireland, north and south, has changed.
How has it changed, or why?
I think once we showed the industry in general that we could take massive television shows and produce them. We have the network there. We have the base there to take these projects on and deliver on huge scales. It opened up all sorts of possibilities. I also think just the amount of projects that are being made at the moment has increased exponentially since Netflix and Amazon
and
Apple have all come on. You know, they've all come on board now and they're all producing their own stuff. So I think the amount of material that's being made has increased, and I think that Ireland in general has shown that it's right at the forefront of being able to produce it. So it's a very exciting time.
Well, it sounds as if it might be a period in time when there is work for actors.
Well, who knows? An old dream.
Well, you're in work at the moment, so I suppose enjoy that aspect of it. Thanks to both of you for coming into us this evening. That's Lynn Parker and Stuart Graham. Children of the Sun is at the Abbey Theatre, on the Abbey stage of the Abbey Theatre, from the 13th of April through until the 11th of May. You can get full details on abbeytheatre.ie. The world built by Alex Garland in his new film Civil War depicts an all too recognisable America ruled over by a three-term president and torn apart by a vicious conflict. The causes of the war remain obscure. All that matters here is the danger of the present moment and the destruction of civilization. In this world, we follow a ramshackle group of journalists on a road trip from New York to Washington, D.C., and what they instinctively feel must be the conflict's bitter end. The film stars Kirsten Dunst as Lee, world-renowned war photographer, grappling with the fact that her years of unflinching work in far-flung conflict zones has done nothing to prevent the bloodshed on her own doorstep. She's accompanied by rookie photographer Jessie, played by Katie Spaney, and Jessie's ruthless drives has echoes of Lee's younger years. Narcos star Wagner Mara, along with veteran actor Steve McKinley, as reporters, complete this group of hacks on the road. I spoke with the writer-director of Civil War, Alex Garland, recently about the project. Before we hear that conversation, let's get a flavour of his new film, Civil War.
19 states have seceded.
The United States Army ramps up activity.
The White House issued warnings to the Western forces as well as the Florida Alliance.
The three-term president assures the uprising will be dealt with swiftly.
Citizens of America,
the so-called Western forces of Texas and California
have suffered a very great defeat at the hands of the United States military.
You started writing Civil War, I believe, Alex, back in 2020. Where did the story come from? Was there one event? Was there a whole series of events?
I think if you think back to 2020, you'll probably remember that there was a kind of ambient worry about polarization, extremism, populism back then, just as there is now, just and in no way contained just to America as a phenomenon. You can certainly find it in the UK. You can certainly find it in Europe. You can find it in the Middle East and Asia and South America. So what did it come out of? It came out of that.
And when, because this is about a civil war, essentially, in America, it could be any country, but you've chosen to set it in America. When the storming of the Capitol came along then on January the 6th, 2021, and you were mid-flight in terms of the writing, what effect did that have on you?
Well, first off, just set it in America because you sort of have to, because that's the biggest, most powerful country in the world by any margin. And sometimes I think people in other countries know more about American politics than they do about their internal politics, in a strange way. In terms of January the 6th, the script was long finished by then. And when the January the 6th stuff happened, weirdly or not weirdly, I'm not sure which one it is, I didn't think about the film at that moment. I was really just reacting to the shock of the event and responding to it just as anybody might. I mean, I guess it depends where you sit on these things, but I felt really angry and a strong sense of disgrace, so it didn't then, though, directly feed into anything within the film in terms of imagery or lines or scenes or anything like that. But I think it probably did feed into the film, maybe less so with me and more with some of the American crew who were working on the film, and gave it, put more anger and more urgency behind them and their work.
Although I think it's important that we point out that, it's difficult to work out even what sides are involved in this particular civil war. You've been very careful in the telling of it, not to give us a whole bundle of background on how this all built up. We just find ourselves in a very recognisable America, but a very recognisable America that's falling apart. Law and order have absolutely disintegrated, and it's difficult to work out who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. It's just two sides fighting against each other.
Yeah, because when everything goes crazy, look, you occasionally get a war or a civil war where you can say, okay, good guys, bad guys. So, the first American Civil War, that's fought over slavery. That's got such a clear ethical right and wrong position over it that you could talk about it in those terms. But usually wars disintegrate just into things in which people are killing other people, and it can reduce to just how do you stay alive, or how do you get from one day to the next, or get from one place to the next, or like the issues could well dissolve under any number of different circumstances that war throws up. So it's that kind of war rather than the more clearly delineated wars or civil wars that you can have. It's a disintegration into violent extremism. Yeah.
And real chaos, and where, summary execution can, it happens as the word suggests, like that. There is no discussion if you annoy somebody. I'm even thinking of one particular scene in the film, Alex, where we get two soldiers. We don't really know what side they're on, but they're watching a sniper in a house.
What's going on?
Someone's trying to kill us. We are trying to kill them.
You don't know what side they're fighting.
It really is about survival.
Yeah. I suppose that's the scene where all of that sort of condenses into as simple as it could be in that moment. But I also think broadly they are like the reporters that are moving across this landscape are constantly encountering different kinds of people with no real sense of what side they're on, or what is there an ideology behind their side, or there are here and there are little clues. So sometimes there's a scene in which people are being executed, and there's a sort of criteria behind who is being executed and who is not being executed.
Yeah.
There's some kind of misunderstanding here.
What?
Well, you're American, okay?
Okay. What kind of American are you? You don't know?
And also, there are some statements made about the president. It's a three-term president, so that says that this is a president who's dismantled the Constitution, they've disbanded the FBI, that means they've removed one of the law enforcement bodies that could potentially prosecute them or challenge them, or so it does have things like that embedded within it. But the idea was that the film itself functioned in the same way as a reporter, an old-fashioned reporter, would function, just by saying, this is what is being observed in this window of time. All I'm doing is telling you what is being observed at this moment, and it's up to you to make an inference.
And therefore we come to that set of reporters, four people in fact, that we get travelling across the states together over to, they want to go to Washington to speak to the president. They believe that he's the White House is going to fall very soon. They want to get that last interview, Wagner Mara being the reporter who wants to get the interview, Kirsten Dunst being the photographer who wants to get the pictures of what is happening, and along with them a younger photographer, Katie Spaney, who kind of bases her character on the Kirsten Dunst character, wants to be the same type of photographer reporter, and an older reporter played by Stephen McKinley, who's seen it all, done it all, and has phenomenal instincts. The presence of the journalism and the presence of the four journalists as our kind of guide through that, you could have chosen anybody in some ways, but journalism, it struck me, seemed to be important to you in that choice.
It's super important to me. I mean, it's partly because I grew up around journalists. My dad was a cartoonist on a newspaper, and I grew up around journalists, around the kitchen table and hearing their conversations and stuff. But it's also because journalism has really been under attack for a long time, but the attacks have got quite extreme, and they're complex attacks. They're sometimes external forces. They're politicians that don't want journalists to be trusted, and so they undermine whether they should be trusted or not. But it's also from within journalism. Sometimes journalists have done a lot to undermine themselves, or some journalists have done a lot to undermine the profession. And
what do you think people have done? What kind of things have undermined the profession?
Bias. In the old days, journalists, so the kind of journalists I grew up with, actually, were very careful about bias. They themselves could have strong feelings. They could be conflicted. They could be compromised as individuals. But when it came to their work, they were very, very careful about stepping outside anything that they just saw as objective facts. And they were quite honorable about that, regardless of what they were like as individuals, in if you see what I mean. And there's two things that journalism has done that are really problematic. One is growth of, not growth, but the power of a certain kind of tabloid journalism that made lying about things routine. And people would read the stories, but they kind of knew to only half trust them. And that was problematic, but nothing like as problematic as having very large, very powerful journalistic institutions, could be print, but particularly on television, that got their revenue from advertising, which meant they needed a constituency. They needed to provide news that the constituency wanted. So they were preaching to a choir, in effect. That meant if you were in a different choir, you did not trust that journalistic institution. And conversely, the people in the choir of, body A did then not trust B. And the overall holistic effect of that was that news reporting was not something that could necessarily be trusted. So in and around that, suddenly you would get crazy theories having enormous amount of traction as a consequence of the established, what sometimes gets called the mainstream media, becoming perceived as, and in some case being, untrustworthy.
Yeah.
And the problem with all of that is that with any kind of free state, or a state which is at least attempting to be fair, you need journalism. It's not like a nice thing to have, it's a necessity.
The fourth estate.
It's the fourth estate. So, and when you don't have it, things go wrong so badly, so quickly, and we are starting to see that.
Yeah, which suggests to me that the kind of America that you're presenting us here, that kind of disintegration, it's not as if it happens all of a sudden. It's a slow drip, and we may be at the beginnings of that in some ways. But I want to talk a little bit about about the way you shot the film, in particular the fact that the Kirsten Dunst character, called Lee, and Lee Miller is mentioned more than once, the famous war photographer here, and the Katie Spaney character, we see them in battle zones, seriously dangerous places to be, where they are taking the same types of risks as the soldiers who are fighting in these battle zones as well. And the shooting of it, it struck me, they have to get out to get their shot, the camera shot, in the same way as a sniper or a gun, the guy with the gun has to get out to get his or her shot. You really hit that nail on the head.
When I set out to make this, somebody said, don't make a film about journalists, everybody hates journalists. And I thought, this is insane. It's like saying everybody hates doctors. The thing you just described is what journalists have to do. They need to see something. A photographer, if they can't see it, they can't shoot it. And so there's whatever compromise they have in terms of their internal life, they also have to be courageous. And so I wanted just to show that courage and that strange integrity that comes with it, because personally, I'm done with journalists being attacked. Whatever I said just then about the institutions, there are such good journalists out there doing such good work. The problem is not whether they're doing the work or not doing the work, it's whether anybody's listening. It's whether they have traction or not. Mm. So part of the focus was just sort of saying like a celebration of journalists in a sense.
The other challenge with that, or one of the challenges within that though, I think is the fact that we do see them taking these huge risks, and they are our heroes in the film. We follow them as heroes. The way that you present that, the challenge of presenting it in its reality and not glorifying the violence that is going on around them and not glorifying their role within that too much in terms of, because it is an anti-war film. I don't think there's any question about that.
That's the balance. And cinema is a slightly weird medium because it has a kind of instinct to glorify everything and romanticize everything. It can't help it because of music, and the frame and the light, and you get these beautiful actors and they look so spectacular, and it just leads you towards romanticizing stuff. So we had to push back against that hard and take some of the things out that a film will normally give you to help you in that romantic direction, and very deliberately kind of put a red line through some of that stuff.
So when we see somebody dying, you present it in a way that would be closer to reality rather than some kind of operatic version of that?
Yeah, exactly. And then the idea is that in some ways, look, somebody may have never seen anyone get shot in reality or on news or whatever, but somehow I think people sense truth. Even if they've never encountered it themselves, they kind of sense when something is truer or less true. And so we that is the kind of thing we pushed it towards reality to make sure it was anti-war and not inadvertently pro-civil war, which would be a crazy thing to do.
One final question, if I could, Alex. I mean, there's so many. You're served by a wonderful cast here. I've mentioned Kirsten Dunst, Katie Spinney, Wagner Mara, Stephen McKinley, Nick Offerman as the president, Jesse Plemons with a wonderful scene that we can't get into describing. But I did want to ask you about 28 Days Later. There are some kind of parallels here in that, again, in that film, which you wrote the screenplay for, we had a society falling apart for different reasons, for sure. Danny Boyle was directing there, but it launched the international career of Cillian Murphy, which obviously is of great interest to us here in Ireland. Can you see a through line for you from that film, 28 Days Later, right through to what you've done here in Civil War?
In a funny way, I can, actually, because I wrote 28 Days Later, weirdly, as a response to having just been in a country that was suffering from a long conflict, in a state of conflict that had been going on for a long time. And I remember coming home and sort of standing in coffee shops, just thinking, like, just the dissonance of it. And it, in a funny way, the idea was dragging a war and taking it to the UK just to shake it up a bit, practically. Just, it's hard to explain that,
yeah.
But the dissonance of being in one kind of place and then arriving home to the way we have it in Europe is quite a stark difference.
And you must have been delighted then, having seen Cillian Murphy early in his career there, to see him pick up that Oscar in recent times.
Do you know what? Actually, I'm gonna show my age and my softness. I actually found it really moving, to be honest. I really did. I found it very, very moving. Cillian was not just someone who I worked with. He and his wife, very, very good friends of the mother of my children. And I saw all this trajectory from this very, very young man. You know, we were all young back then. And, you know, he was in his very early 20s. And it's an extraordinary journey he's done, absolutely extraordinary. And there's another thing as well, which is that he wears it very lightly and very intelligently. He has not become corrupted,
yeah,
as so many people are by the force of those pressures. You even know him. He is a smart guy.
Yeah.
He is a highly intelligent man, and he's got a kind of sensitivity and honesty about him. And it stood him in very good stead, and it was amazing to see him get to that place. So, yes, it was a terrific moment. I was so happy for him.
And I think you weren't alone in that, Alex Garland. That was Alex Garland there speaking so kindly and generously about Cillian Murphy at the end of that interview about Alex's film Civil War, which goes on general release in cinemas on Friday. We will be reviewing it on Thursday night's Arena. Caledonian Road is the latest novel from Scottish writer Andrew O'Hagan. The road of the title is the London artery that connects King's Cross, Islington and the Holloway Road. And it is here that the story begins in May 2021, ends 1 year and 656 pages later. The novel is a state of the nation story about one man's fall from grace, Campbell Flynn, an art historian and celebrity intellectual. But he is approaching middle age and an existential crisis. As the book unfolds, Flynn struggles as a web of crimes, secrets and scandals is revealed. Delighted to be joined on the line now by Andrew O'Hagan. He's an extraordinary character in and of himself, Andrew, this Campbell Flynn chap with the two surnames as a name, as it were, which is kind of a very Scottish thing, I think, perhaps in some ways. He comes from nothing, but when we meet him at the beginning of this novel, he is, on the surface, a wonderfully successful man. What was the attraction of the surface bit of that, I guess, is what the attraction was in looking at him?
I think it's always been a classic thing in the novel of society, Sean. The idea of this man or woman who appear to have everything. You know, this tall, elegant man who seems to be at the top of his career. He's an art historian. He's invited onto all the programs. He's a writer for The New Yorker. He's that successful guy with the big wedding cake of a house in Islington in North London, who nevertheless has something off about him. Something's beginning to fracture in his life. And we begin as readers to see over the course of the story that this guy is really in desperate straits now. He's undermining his own life. And albeit that he's supposed to have everything, at the core of him, there's a regret and a lack of confidence, which is pulling him apart. He's about to sort of face his biggest crisis.
And I love the quote from Robert Louis Stevenson: after a certain distance, every step we take in life, we find the ice growing thinner below our feet. Did you somehow identify with that Robert Louis Stevenson statement itself, Andrew? And indeed,
I've always really loved that. You know, the idea that, you know, as we get older, we're supposed to get wiser, aren't we? We're supposed to get more settled. But in fact, maybe it's just as you quote, the thin ice beneath us becomes more apparent, and you begin to see your friends going through, and God forbid, you begin to see yourself going through. You know, that's the drama anyway. You know, that no matter how much self-satisfaction and how much achievement and public acclaim a person can have, there can be something off. And I think it's true, by the way, for a whole generation of men and women in their 50s, of which I am one, by the way. Mm. So I would adventure that I know what I'm talking about when it comes to this, that there's a generation who thought they were solid. They thought they were walking on not thin ice, but on solid ground, terra firma, that we had worked out how to be good liberal people, how to be, inclusive, how to be on the right side of history. But what we're finding, if you look into the eyes of the younger generation and their mistrust of us, and I say this as a parent, by the way, they begin to look at you as if maybe you didn't have all the cards, maybe you didn't have all the answers. In fact, your generation put up with a lot of attitudes towards women, towards race, towards, you know, tolerating nonsense in our society, which we would never put up with, they say to us. So we're beginning to be questioned, perhaps for the first time, by that new generation. I think it's undermining us. And that's really what the book, you know, it grows up from that.
Yeah, this idea that, in fact, that wonderful outer surface that Campbell Flynn has, that it's covering up so much mess. It has to be said, many of the people that we meet in the novel, you'd be forgiven if for any younger person reading it to say, yeah, you see what I mean? I mean, we have all sorts of people in here. We have traffickers, sex traffickers. Yep. We have modern day slavery. We have people migrants being brought over in trucks. We have all sorts of situations that are really
and dukes
dark.
And duchesses and members of the aristocracy. The English establishment, in fact, Sean, is something that I wanted to sort of turn inside out in this book. We take it for granted because, you know, it's a nation over here. People are obsessed with the royal family and obsessed with the aristocracy and posh houses and all of that. But in fact, there's something I would argue, and certainly the novel argues, that there's something wrong with that establishment. Its connections to dirty money that is being laundered in London through the last couple of decades. Russian oligarchs able to set themselves up in London and turn London into a sort of modern-day Casablanca, a place where the availability of deluxe housing that nobody really asked too many questions about where the money was coming to buy it, these offshore accounts being able to be deployed to buy hugely multi-million quid art objects and houses, and never really the accountants nor the lawyers there to question that. What we found in London was a great laundromat, and that was supported very often by the proper establishment in this country. So somebody someday was going to write a novel after austerity, after Brexit, after the pandemic, somebody, and it turned out to be me, it looks, was going to take up these themes and actually make a big drama out of them.
Yes, and it has that. It has that dramatic aspect to it. But references have been made in various reviews and people talking about the novel to the Dickensian nature of the book.
Yes.
It really goes across all of society, and it looks at some of those great injustices in the way that Dickens did of his own society back in the 19th century. Was that in your mind in some ways, Andrew?
Oh, hugely inspiring. You know, I grew up as a wee boy in Scotland loving two writers, loving Dickens and his great panoramas of social life, where one page he'd be inside an orphanage or a place for fallen women, the next page he'd be in the House of Lords or in a palace or at a huge fancy dinner table. That is the kind of writer he was, you know, spreading his imagination right across a whole society. And my other great writer was James Joyce, who equally, by the way, this book's called Caledonian Road. It's about a city. And of course, Ulysses, the great novel, in one city, in one day. You know, I always loved that quote from Joyce when it was said that he imagined that if Dublin was to be destroyed, that you could rebuild it from the pages of his novel. So and that's hugely inspiring for a young writer. You know, London has had many novelists, mainly Dickens, though, and he is the one who is unafraid, Sean, to take you into any space in the head, in any space in the world, any living room, any sitting room, any public space as well. And that's inspiring. It has been for me all the way through writing this book, and it took 10 years of research because, of course, I had to go into those places myself, into the House of Lords, into those country houses, the world of the oligarchs spending tens of thousands of pounds on bottles of wine in these clubs in London. I had to witness that. So I was undercover for quite a lot of the time I was writing this book in order to get the detail.
And there's a very human side to particularly though we see immigrants who are working in sweatshops essentially, and that they're in the case of one of the, you know, he's just trying to get himself up the ladder in the sweatshop so that he can get a passport sorted to get his partner over to the country so that they can start a new life together. Those darker sides of, not saying that, you know, all the stuff you've mentioned about the corruption in the House of Lords and in the higher echelons of society, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But the darker side, the sex trafficking side, the modern slavery side, how did you go about researching or imagining those?
Well, I had to research it because I'm one of those believers in the fact that, you know, readers have got very fine intelligence, very fine instincts for bullshit and for what's not actually trustworthy or viable. And so I've spent many years inside those worlds where people are coming in vans and in the back of containers through the tunnel from Europe or across in container ships. In fact, I was 28 weeks at the Old Bailey following the case, the now very famous case of the several dozen Vietnamese trafficked individuals who died at Purfleet or on the way to Purfleet in Essex. And these are real cases, and I had to get inside them and try and map that journey, the desperate journey towards London with all the hope that you've mentioned that there's a better life there. These are economic migrants. They don't leave their hometowns, their parents, their loved ones for a laugh.
No,
they leave because they're desperate economically, and their home villages have often been destroyed by the forces of modern industry and capital. Their rivers were polluted by chemical companies from America and so on. I discovered when I looked back into the villages that many of those Vietnamese people had come from. So the story has to take all that in, because the reader, finally, having watched the news all these years, should be able to pick up a novel now and again that gives them the inner life of all these things, connects it all up to show you the society working.
That's what really struck me, was with the humanity. We get the human experience of many of the people in those unfortunate and very dark situations. However, in the midst of all the corruption that seems to be essential to a civilized society, there are some beacons of light, and one of whom is a hacker, a young hacker called Milo, who seems to be, at the point I'm at any rate, seems to be a beacon of light in the midst of all of this, who says at one point something along the lines of, everyday politics is defensive these days. he said. Then he goes on, and often not the brave activism it pretends to be. If you meet a young person who's pursuing real action rather than merely segregating people and policing vocabulary, it's a golden opportunity. It is Milo that says that, I think, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yes.
He really is hitting something in terms of the policing of vocabulary there that it struck me. Did you feel that sometimes as a novelist?
I did, you know, and often when I spent time with young activists and ethical hackers and so on, it was magical when you met one who really did believe in real change. That's to say, improving the condition of the poor, better wages for women, better working conditions for people, you know, equality, actually changing society in tangible ways rather than just ticking people off for saying the wrong word. Mm. Which is a huge mania in society now, that as a whole generation, it seems, can be devoted to policing what people like us might say. And of course you want to get things right. Of course you want to use the right pronouns. I'm all for it. But more important, I would argue, is the idea of instituting real change in people's lives. And that's when you come across that in a young activist, it is, as I've said in the book, I think, it's gold. And, you know, you've got to remember something in the middle of all this. We've been talking about serious things, but the great example that Dickens gives us, Sean, in the end, is the comedy of manners. This is a comedy at its core, the comedy of the different ways of viewing life and different ways of living. And I, for over the 10 years that I was working on it, was obsessed with the idea that you could get to very serious subjects, for sure, but the means would be comical. Yeah. These people would have humour and would be driven by differences which were, you know, the cause of belly laughs as well as concern.
Absolutely. And just one final question, and I'm nearly out of time, so if we can be brief on it. But I did read today, I think, that Caledonian Road is going to be dramatised by the people who gave us Chernobyl and Slow Horses. Is this true?
Yes, indeed. It's been fantastic news, actually, today. It's been announced in the Hollywood Reporter that a returning series will be coming out of Caledonian Road, so you'll be seeing it on your screens very soon.
Are you involved in the writing, or did you just hand it over and say
yes?
You are involved in
the writing? No, no. I mean, I'm usually quite happy just to sort of, you know, take the money and run. In this case, I'm going to be an executive producer, and I'm involved with a brilliant team of people in trying to realise this big drama. So I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, that will be exciting when it makes its way to the screens. In the meantime, people can get down into the joy that is the 656 pages or thereabouts of the novel in its sprawling wonder. Thanks so much for speaking with us this evening, Andrew.
What a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Andrew O'Hagan. And Caledonian Road is published by Faber. That is our lot for this Monday evening. It is Monday, isn't it? Yes. Niall Fitzmaurice and Leah Murphy were the researchers this evening. David Phelan was the broadcast coordinator. Dave Gibson was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby.